Good morning and welcome. It's Friday, the 4th of October. Welcome to the Roundtable Special Lockbox Edition. I'm Joe Donahue. This morning, first of all, congratulations to everyone. Great job to Ray Graff and to the amazing David Gustina and their incredible work this morning. Everybody who called in, everybody who gave. We made the challenge. Congratulations. Yay. All right. And now we get the prize, which is a really great discussion. And on the special Lockbox edition this morning, as we feature in-depth conversation on the state of journalism with the one and only Marty Baron. Martin Baron is a longtime journalist and newspaper editor. He ran the newsrooms of the Miami Herald and the Boston Globe before being named executive editor of the Washington Post in 2013. His role in launching an investigation of the Catholic Church's cover-up of sexual abuse by clergy was portrayed in the Academy Award-winning movie Spotlight. Baron retired from daily journalism in early 2021, now splits his time between New York and Western Massachusetts, where he spends most of his time and where he joins us this morning. As we work before and after this conversation to fill the lockbox to support WAMC, I'm joined for this special panel by three regular panelists and our own journalistic all-stars. Semi-retired editor-at-large, columnist, editorial writer at the Times Union, Jay Jochnowitz. Good morning, Jay.
Good morning.
We also welcome Vice President for Editorial Development at the New York Press Association, Judy Patrick. Hello, Judy.
Good morning. Good morning.
And former Times Union Associate Editor Mike Spain. Hello, Mike.
Hello. Good morning. Happy to be here.
And we are thrilled to welcome Marty Baron to the program. His new book is Collision of Power. It is out in paperback as of Tuesday. If you have not read the hardcover edition, the convenient paperback edition will be out on October 8th, and it is an absolute thrill to welcome Marty back to the program. Thank you so much for being with us, sir. What a delight.
Thanks for having me.
It's so nice to have you on the program. As you've been going around over the last year, talking about the book, talking about your career, talking about journalism, what has struck you about what interests people about the subject, about the state of journalism today, and how we as citizens and readers and consumers are interacting with it?
Well, I think the primary concern is whether journalism is fulfilling its role in our democracy. There's a lot of concern about the state of democracy in the country. And there are a lot of questions about how and whether media institutions are doing the job that's necessary, given the condition that we're in. And I think that's the primary concern that that people have.
When you think of those primary concerns, how have those changed just since the time that you retired?
Well, we have a presidential election, and so I think people are very much focused on the choice that's in front of them, and people are very uncertain about the direction of the country and very concerned about the direction of the country, and I think that comes from both ends of the political spectrum, but people have their own particular interests, of course, and particular perspective on what are appropriate public policies, and there's a lot of I think concern that democracy is in an exceptionally fragile state. And the question is, how well will democracy survive? Is there adequate support among the general public for our democratic institutions? Is there adequate support for the role of the press, which is one of the pillars of democracy? And whether the press, what exactly should the press be doing to fulfill its role, and how well is it performing in this particular election? So, I left shortly after January 6, 2021. So I left at the end of February 2021. So that was just the beginning of the Biden administration. And so I think a lot has changed in that time. Obviously, the country is very much involved in, I mean, we're sort of entangled in one way or another in a couple of wars around the world, in Ukraine, the Middle East, People have their concerns about the economy. We had a high rate of inflation, which has since subsequently moderated considerably to a low level at the moment. And you know, people are concerned about the border. People are concerned about the, as I said before, the fragile state of democracy. You know, people are concerned about issues of women's rights, particularly. There's a large amount of support for the right to an abortion, and concern that the kinds of measures that are being taken in individual states are putting women in jeopardy, their own health in jeopardy. So there are a lot of concerns, and then the question is, how should the press respond to that?
Marty, I loved your book, and one of the reasons I loved it is it comes through loud and clear that you were a real working editor. I mean, you were on the ground, a nuts and bolts kind of editor. So my question is, how would you tell a reporter, or what advice would you give a reporter covering the Trump campaign, specifically a Trump rally? How should they be covering those?
Sure. Well, first of all, thanks for those remarks. It's nice to know that people paid me for doing some actual work. Thank you so much. And that money wasn't presumably wasted. Look, I mean, it's not just a matter of covering the rally itself. I mean, I certainly covering the rally. You know, I mean, it depends on what happens at the rally. There's been a lot of debate lately over if Trump is speaking incoherently, which does happen with some frequency, how you should report on that. And I certainly think that if he's not making any sense, then you should make that clear and not try to make what is incoherent coherent. Some people have used the term sane washing. I don't particularly like that term because it's not a matter of sanity. It's a matter of coherence. But overall, in terms of the campaign itself, I mean, I think that it's important that we cover the kinds of policies that each of the candidates intends to implement, who they intend to implement them with, who they would have as part of their administration, how they would go about implementing that, given the existing laws in this country and the Constitution that we have. And what kind of impact would those policies have on the lives of ordinary people? Those are the things that I think we should focus on most. Now, of course, an election, people bemoan that there's a lot of focus on the horse race, but an election is a horse race. The reason that we're talking about Kamala Harris as a candidate, the reason that she is the nominee for the Democratic Party, is because there was such concern within the Democratic Party about how Joe Biden would fare in that horse race. So you can't ignore the horse race. It's very important. But I think that we can cover the substantive issues at the same time. We can walk and chew gum at the same time. We can cover the policy matters as well as the horse race. And I think the policy matters are by far the most important. And we ought to be looking at, you asked about Trump in particular, so we ought to be looking at what his policies are. And the reality is that the kinds of policies that he has spoken openly about, he's not hiding anything. The kinds of policies that he has spoken openly about are exactly the kinds of policies that we've seen in other countries that have moved in an authoritarian direction. And you know, you talk about bringing treason charges against your perceived political enemies, including people who worked in his own administration. He talks about bringing treason charges against some of the networks and withdrawing their licenses, their ability to operate, simply because their coverage is not to his liking. He has actually spoken about termination of the Constitution because of his assertion, entirely false, by the way, that the 2020 election was fraudulent. So, you know, a whole range of, he's talked about using the military to suppress the protests, entirely legitimate protests for that matter. So those are the kinds of measures that we have seen in other countries that have moved in an authoritarian direction. And I think it's important to point that out. It's not a matter of opinion. It's just a matter of fact.
Just a side question to that, a follow-up of how you feel. There was an article in the New York Times about a week ago about how Senator Vance, while on the trail, will often do news conferences in front of the audience at rallies and will basically use reporters as props. And then turning on the reporters in real time and talking about how awful the press is and so forth. To going to Judy's question, I mean, how much should your reporter be a part of that nonsense?
Well, I don't think we should be. I don't think we should be used as props for any candidate. You know, they speak against the press, but, you know, somebody like J.D. Vance, he's actually doing quite a few interviews, both with friendly media and other media that that I think is more independent. You look, I mean, we're a convenient enemy. We get blamed for everything. We get blamed by the Democrat. We get blamed for everything. We get blamed for, for being too harsh on Trump. We get blamed for being too easy on Trump. We get blamed for being too harsh on Joe Biden. We get blamed for being too easy on Joe Biden. We get blamed for just about everything. And it's so convenient for politicians to point to the press. We're just the convenient enemy. And look, I mean, even during the debate with Tim Walz, when J.D. Vance was asked about some of the really harsh things that he has said about Donald Trump in the past, about his economic policies having been a failure, what he said about compared Donald Trump to Hitler. I mean, that's all on the record. He basically said, well, I believe what I read in the media. Now, here's a guy who went to an Ivy League school, who's really smart and discerning, presumably, and the idea that somehow he's been duped by the media is just not, it's just not credible. He said what he believed at the time, and he may have changed his opinion, or he just may have changed what he has to say publicly to get elected. But to sort of blame the media for his own beliefs when he was, he's a guy, as I said, who went to an Ivy League school, really smart. He worked in the investment industry as a venture capitalist. He wrote a book that was highly successful, best-selling book. The idea that he can't think for himself is just preposterous.
Jay Jacknowitz.
Yeah, I think we probably look at this from the same point of view, and I think everybody in this room probably does too, from except for Joe, who's radio, but we look at it from a print point of view. And I was struck this morning by a New York Times headline, and it was a very short article. Former President Trump held a rally in Michigan that was notable mainly for his continued false statements. And I thought, you know, that's exactly what you need to do, just a short and sweet editorial that, you know, says here's what he did. Yes, not editorial. I'm sorry. It's
headline.
A news story and headline that, you know, covers it. I'm curious, though, since you're retired, you probably have a little more time to watch TV. How the network and cable news is handling this, which I think is what all the soul searching was about, that he was so entertaining to watch. And I said this back in 2016, and it grated on my wife when I said, he is magical. There is something about him that is very charismatic and very compelling to watch. Do you think they're doing a better job on TV of presenting whatever mistake we as the media industry made in 2016, do you think we've fixed that?
Well, first of all, I don't really watch much TV. Part of it is because, first of all, it takes a lot of time. And secondly, I don't really like what I see on a lot of particularly cable television. Mm-hmm. And I do think that there have been some significant, and also I think that cable television has just become, you know, too partisan in its approach. And particularly some individual networks, and both on the right and the left. But I do think there were some significant mistakes made at the beginning. And one, for example, was CNN. Well before any primary was held, CNN gave a full interview to Donald Trump, and as usual, he steamrolled the interviewer. And the only reason that CNN did that interview was to try to demonstrate to the world, to the American public, that it was open to Republicans. And so that's a marketing reason for having an interview. It's not a journalistic reason for having an interview. Mm-hmm. They declared him essentially to be the front runner before a single primary had been held. And I thought that was highly premature. And as I said, not done for journalistic reasons. The same thing with NBC when they had a new host for Meet the Press. they wanted to promote their new host. So, of course, what do? You ask Donald Trump for an interview, and he happily accepted. And once again, he largely steamrolled the interviewer. And no primary had been held. There was no particular reason for them to give him an hour. And they did. And I think that those sorts of things make no sense. I think we need to stick to our journalistic purpose. We shouldn't be doing things strictly for marketing reasons, particularly when it involves the presidency of the United States, which is, by the way, the single most powerful position in the entire world. Those were big mistakes, and they were akin to what happened back in 2015 and 2016 when Trump was first running, when CNN and Fox were running Trump's rallies from beginning to end without any commentary, without any contradiction, without letting him say whatever he wanted, much of it false, much of it very, very incendiary. And basically, that's kind of in-kind advertising to a candidate's campaign. So I was concerned about that. I do think that, as you mentioned, that I think people are being more direct. I think the press overall, including cable outlets, are being more direct about what's false. Every once in a while, Fox will even point that out, which is an exception, not the rule for Fox, sadly. And I think that's a good thing, is that we should point out what he's saying when he's saying something false and document why it's false. Whether that makes it any difference with the American public is another matter. We live in a highly polarized society. We're largely tribal at this point. Most people have already decided who they're going to vote for. Probably only a single-digit percentage is undecided. And so these kinds of this kind of fact-checking probably doesn't have any real-world impact. But I think it's important for the historical record and for the fulfillment of our own mission that we continue to do that.
Do you think CBS made the right decision in saying they weren't going to fact-check the debate live, the vice presidential debate the other night?
Well, they did a little fact-checking.
They did. They sure did.
So that came up in the Joe Biden-Donald Trump interview debate as well. My reaction to that at the time was, well, why didn't Joe Biden fact-check Donald Trump? He didn't, of course. He was having great difficulty uttering complete thoughts and complete sentences, frankly, so which was really disturbing. But it's fundamentally the job of the candidate to fact check the other candidate. It's called a debate for a reason. Mm-hmm. I think there's some instances where it makes sense to inject what the facts are, but I don't think you want the moderators fact-checking every last word that the candidates say. That would be highly disruptive to the debate. It relieves the candidates of doing their own job as a debater. So I think when there's something hugely consequential would just pass by unnoticed, at times it makes sense for the moderators to inject themselves. And I don't think that what the moderators did in either this debate or in the Trump-Kamala Harris debate was anything unusual or inappropriate.
Mike Spann from Marty Baron.
Marty, you talked about how one of the things that the media needs to do is talk about policy, talk about what the impact of Trump's own words would be if they were carried out as policy. And I think the media has done that. They've done that a lot lately. They've talked about, impact on the Justice Department, impact if he was to do his immigration plan, et cetera, et cetera. And you can get that information from many, many trustworthy, reliable sources. And why is this election so close then? People say that to me, and I don't have a good answer. If we're doing our job telling people the truth, and I believe we are. I think it's available, widely available. How come this election is down to micro percentage points in swing states? What has happened? Have we failed after trying to do the job?
No, I don't think, this is, again, one of those instances where some people conclude, well, a lot of people conclude, well, it must be the press's fault. I don't think that's the case here. I think that the reality is that we live in a highly divided society in terms of our positions on policies and who we really identify with. It's highly polarized. We've had close elections. We always have close elections. I mean, we had a close election with Hillary Clinton. We had a close election when Donald Trump was running against Hillary Clinton. We had a close election when Joe Biden was running against Donald Trump. So we have a close election now. I mean, remember back to George W. Bush and Al Gore. That was a really close election. And I happened to be the editor of the Miami Herald at the time. And it was 537 votes in Florida that decided that election. So that's like super close. So we have a very divided society. The other thing is that I think it's important to point out that actually the polls show that twice as many people think that Kamala Harris is truthful as think that Donald Trump is truthful. It's just, you know, very small percent, relatively small percentage, maybe only about a third of the electorate who thinks that Donald Trump is truthful. But even people who don't think he's truthful will still intend to vote for him because they're not voting on the basis of whether they think he lies or doesn't lie or whether he's disciplined or isn't disciplined or whether they think he's a good guy, they like him personally or whether they don't like him personally. You know, the people who support him are, first of all, they think he speaks for them. They think the so-called elites have ignored them, and they include the press and what they consider to be the elites. Although most of the press isn't paid like the elites, that's for sure. You know, their people are concerned about, you look at what the issues are people are concerned about. Well, okay, inflation. You know, for a couple of years there, we had high inflation, and we can talk about what the reasons are for that. And that's another matter. But the inflation affects more people than unemployment does. So, you know, you had high level of unemployment at the end of the Trump administration as a result of the pandemic and how we managed the pandemic. But, you know, unemployment affects a much smaller percentage of people as inflation. Inflation affects everybody, the cost of gas, the cost of milk, the cost of eggs, all groceries, you name it, the cost of housing, mortgage rates, all of those sorts of things. And then you look at the, okay, then there's another issue, which is the border, which ranks high among the concerns of people. And yes, we did have enormous numbers of people crossing the border, and it was soaring in the first couple of years of the Biden administration. And so people are concerned about that. So there are a whole range of things that that rank as concerns on the part of the American public, and they see Trump as somebody who will do that, will address it, even if, you know, what he says is offensive. I mean, even if you go back to 2015 when he first ran for the presidency, when he was in the primaries, and he talked about Mexican immigrants being rapists, you know, we in the press and a good portion of the American public understandably focused on A, that's inaccurate, and B, that's incredibly defensive and discriminatory in its language, and derogatory toward, you know, ordinary people. But, you know, a lot of the American public didn't focus on what we were focusing on. They said, well, here's somebody who's going to do something about the problem on the border. That was their takeaway from that. That's the prism that through which they looked at this. And, you know, the same thing when he put his ban on Muslim immigrants, you know, those of us in the press, we looked at that and said, well, that's discriminatory. It may violate the Constitution and the laws of the country and all of that. And those are legitimate concerns, totally legitimate concerns. But a good portion of the public looks at that and say, oh, well, he's going to do something about terrorism. Now, whether that's the right response to terrorism is another matter. But that is the prism through which they're looking at it. And I think it's really important that we see things through the eyes of others, even people with whom we don't necessarily agree or whose thinking process is something that we think is faulty. But those are concerns that people have. And so it's not a matter of, you know, we fact checked him and he's telling falsehoods, and therefore you're, you know, according to some people, well, therefore you don't vote for him. They have real concerns. And, you know, even on the democracy matter, you know, somehow Trump has been able to flip that. I mean, here's a guy who in reality incited a riot and incited people to attack Capitol police officers and others, and to enter the Capitol and threaten to hang the vice president of the United States with the purpose of reversing the results of the election, overturning the results of that election, and keeping Donald Trump in office while Donald Trump sat in the White House and did nothing, and actually tweeted that that Vice President Pence had done the wrong thing. But, you know, now people look and they say, oh, well, Trump's being prosecuted, and therefore, you know, it's the Biden administration that is weaponizing the government, even if the facts don't support that. There's no evidence that Biden has interfered in any of these Justice Department investigations. And many of the investigations, by the way, are not even being done by the federal government. They're being done at the state and local level. And so where the federal government is not even involved. But, you know, people look at that and they say they think their candidate is being persecuted. So people look at things in a very different way from the way that I think a lot of us in the press look at it.
They absolutely do.
Marty Baron is our guest on the roundtable in this special Lockboxed edition. The new book, Collision of Power, Trump, Bezos, and the Washington Post. The book comes out in paperback on Tuesday. We're going to take a Lockbox break and go over to Pledge Central. We'll be back in just about 5 minutes and continue our conversation with Marty Baron. Back to Ray Graff.
Oh, we tricked you, Joe. Sorry, but you can't see us. It's Sarah LaDuke and David Gustina. Good morning, everybody.
So glad to be back with you once again.
We did
again.
The old switcheroo.
Yeah, you know, that's what happens. We have windows, but apparently there's a wall in between us and Joe and the panel.
We're just exactly invisible from where Joe is positioned this morning. 800-323-9262. We are raising money for WAMC this morning around the special roundtable panel, The State of Journalism and the Media. The media's part in the news while covering the news. 800-323-9262, a very interesting conversation. We're hoping to hear from you to shorten the fun drive while we fill the lockbox.
You know, it's just so great to be with you, Sarah LaDuke, around a
Likewise,
program that
DG.
You produce and offer your creative efforts in so many other ways to this radio station. And when we're sitting here together with just well under five now to go, we don't have a lot of time to share, but we do know what brings us together each and every day. From the moment you came in as my producer in the morning and the news to all these years later when you're a shining star at WAMC.
Goodness. Hardly.
And, you know, it's part of those things that listeners, I think, respond to. They've been with us for a long time.
Yeah, they respond. They're like, you guys sure about her?
No. 1-800-323-9262. They helped us make the challenge. We made it to the $300,000 mark. In fact, we're at $302,000. $399. And now we're witness to an incredible conversation with Marty Baron and, you know, most of our media project folks.
That's right.
Like Mike Spain and Judy Patrick and, of course, Jay Jochnowitz there today. And we've been asking you, what's your most trusted news source or sources?
Yeah.
And we've been getting some answers, Sarah, like Anonymous of Greenwich, New York. We trust legitimate news sources like WAMC. One cannot trust the guy that plops himself in front of a microphone in his garage and calls himself a newsman.
I agree.
Yeah, I don't know that person. Social media is also not a good place for news, and neither is Fox News, as producers skew everything to make Republicans look favorable. A good news source reports on things and does not take sides. 1-800-323-9262. Well, we try to give you a fair shot to information. We're trying to motivate you to understand that without a public radio station, without a conversation about the truth, about what's happening around us, we can't make those decisions about our lives to help ourselves. And it's all for this community that we're doing what we're doing now. 1-800-323-9262. Sarah LaDuke, make it happen.
1-800-323-9262.
Over to you.
Oh, just that? We're so grateful for everybody who showed up so far. As David mentioned a very few minutes ago, we have raised so far in the lockbox $302,399,
wow,
which is absolutely incredible. Yeehaw. It's an outpouring from so many listeners turned members, or members who are coming back again who've given to us and helped us get this far. But the full total we need to raise to keep our operating budget operating is $1.25 million before the end of this fund drive cycle. That's not what we have to raise today. That's the whole fund drive. And we have a good little chunk of it in, but we do need to keep going. And that's where you listening to us out there come in. Please call 800-323-9262 or go online at wamc.org. You can pledge online, but we also have lovely folks in Pledge Central here ready to take your calls.
They are staring at us intently right now, wondering why the phones aren't ringing. But let
me
tell you,
doing their Wordles.
The reason is because we have been getting pledges, like Victor in Hudson, New York, Susan of Pocock, New York, new member Mark of Pine Plains, Anonymous of Greenwich, Anonymous of Saratoga Springs, Janice and Skip from Safety Harbor, Florida.
Florida.
Existing anonymous member, Huntington, Massachusetts. Trusted News, NPR, PBS, BBC, The Guardian, and Reuters.
There you go.
Elise of Salisbury, Connecticut. Can't start my day without WAMC. Castleton, New York. Sean checking in. Andrew and Joseph from Bloomingsburg, New York. WAMC is my default station. And Anonymous of Great Barrington, Massachusetts.
The greatest of Barringtons. 1-800-323-9262 or online at WAMC.org. Gussie and I are with you for just about another 20 seconds, and then we go back to the special roundtable panel on the state of journalism with Martin Barron, Judy Patrick, Mike Spain, and Jay Jochnowitz, of course, hosted by the incomparable Joseph Donahue, our friend and colleague. Please keep pledging and let us know who are your trusted media sources. The phone number 800-323-9262. Back to Studio Deej.
Right. Thank you very much, Sarah LaDuke. We appreciate it. Wonderful. I'm sorry, David. I really couldn't see you through the wall, and I apologize for that, for my handoff of not seeing you. I should have felt your presence as I have for these many years, but I apologize for that. Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable in this Lockbox edition, a special edition of the Roundtable. We couldn't be more thrilled. We have a true journalism superstar with us, and we couldn't be more thrilled. Marty Barron is here, a longtime journalist and newspaper editor, ran the newsrooms of the Miami Herald, the Boston Globe, and of course, the Washington Post. His book is Collision of Power, Trump, Bezos, and the Washington Post. And we're also joined, I should mention, by three of our panel regulars who are dear friends, and we love them. They're also incredibly talented journalists, and so to have them here to help facilitate this conversation is a great privilege. Jay Jochnowitz is here from the Times Union, editorial writer. He says he's semi-retired. I don't know if I buy it, but okay. Judy Patrick is with us, vice president for the editorial development at the New York Press Association, and former Times Union associate editor Mike Spain. Marty, in writing the book, you spend time looking at a lot of time in the book about the Washington Post. Give us a sense of what that switch was like for you to take that job, and what your thoughts were going in to it.
Sure. Well, I never expected to be going there. I actually had applied to the Washington Post in 1979 when I was a young reporter, and they rejected me. So after that, I figured I'm not going to Washington, and I had no aspirations for going to Washington. And I always found Washington to be a strange place when I actually had to do some reporting there. And I did in fact think that it was quite a bubble, where people thought they were implementing policies that would change the lives of ordinary people. And I was pretty well convinced, having grown up outside of Washington, well outside of Washington, that they weren't going to have that impact and might actually have a lot of unintended effects as well. So I was pretty skeptical of Washington, but I got a call that there was going to be an opening for an editor there, and interviewed, got the job. It was a pretty tough time there. The Post was shrinking. It was laying off people. There was a strong sense within the newsroom that they were losing out to the New York Times, that a number of the people had left the Post to go elsewhere. And there was concern about the future of the Post. And so, you know, I had already dealt with the economic pressures of the business. I dealt with it in Miami. I dealt with it in Boston, where I actually had to cut the staff in the newsroom by about 40% total. So I was quite concerned that I would just have to do the same thing at the Washington Post. And in fact, in the first year, I did have to make cuts. I cut about 35 people in the newsroom. There were about 580 people in the newsroom at that time. And I thought I'd just be doing more of that. And I knew that the pressures were enormous. And we didn't, to be honest, I mean, there was no clear strategy for the Post at that time. And so I didn't quite know where it would lead, but what I was focused on was, can we do really good and highly impactful journalism? And we did in that first year. But it was a big surprise to me. 7 months after I got there, I learned that Jeff Bezos was going to be acquiring the Washington Post.
Right.
I never expected anything like that. I thought the Graham family, which had owned the Post for 80 years, would continue to own the Post forever. I mean, the name of the parent company was the Washington Post Company. And who thinks that the Washington Post Company is going to sell the Washington Post? So, but it did, and the deal closed in October. My reaction to that was that I thought, on the whole, that would be good for the Post. I just didn't know if it was going to be good for me. Probably wouldn't be, I thought, because usually when you have a new owner, you get a new editor.
Right.
And and so I was thinking what else I might be doing. But fortunately, Bezos kept me on for that first year. And then he dismissed our publisher, who was a member of the Graham family, Catherine Weymouth. And then I figured, well, we're getting a new publisher, so the new calculus now is usually new publisher means new editor. And that didn't happen either. So he kept me as well. And so, but anyway, I thought that Bezos would really focus on growing and that he would come with some fresh ideas, which we desperately needed in our profession. He knew technology, of course. He had resources to invest, but he also had, I think, very importantly, a good sense of consumer behavior and consumer sentiment and how to interact with the consumer, and that would be super important for us going forward.
We have about 2 or 3 minutes before we take a top of the hour break, but what were those early conversations with Jeff Bezos like as you're, I assume, feeling each other out?
Yeah, well... Yeah, I mean, I wasn't asking him a lot of questions. He was asking a lot of questions. So, you know, I think I had a good sense as to how to keep my job. But the look, I mean, he said very clearly that he thought we didn't have the right strategy. He said that right up front, right at the beginning. We were essentially a regional newspaper. Yes, we did cover national politics. But other than that, we were covering the Washington metro area. So the district, Northern Virginia, Maryland, all of that. And he felt that we had an opportunity to be national because we had the name The Washington Post, because we were based in the nation's capital, and because we had this history and heritage going back to Watergate, where we were known for shining a light in dark corners, for holding power to account. And so there were millions of people around the country and around the world who had never read a word of The Washington Post, but were familiar with it and actually had a good opinion of it. And so we could build on that, and that the internet, which had destroyed essentially every pillar of our business, had also given us a gift. And of course, we sat there and wondered what that might be. And he said, you know, we were able to distribute our journalism without having to deliver a physical newspaper, which meant that the cost of acquiring an additional reader or an additional subscriber was effectively zero. And so he instructed us to come up with some ideas about how we might expand nationally. And we went about the business of trying to come up with some ideas, and ultimately he financed those, and just about all of them were successful.
Marty Baron is our guest. The name of the new book is Collision of Power, Trump, Bezos, and the Washington Post. In just a minute or so, we're going to go over to a legal ID and then also come back to the Pledge Central location, where they will bang the drums a bit more to help make money for programs exactly like this, and to support the types of programs that you are saying that you want and that we're giving you during this time. And we thank you very much for everything. I do want to mention, too, if you have any questions that you would like to include and have us, when we come back, we'll have about 25 minutes straight, and we can get a lot in. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We'll continue with our My wonderful co-panelists here today, my co-hosts today, Jay Jochnowitz, Judy Patrick, and Mike Spain. We will continue our conversation on this lockbox edition of the Roundtable with Marty Baron after this.
1-800-323-9262. I'm Sarah LaDuke.
I'm David Gustina.
And we are here to remind you that it is time to fill the lockbox. That is the big purpose we have.
And there's two words right here, Sarah. Urgent, positive, right? It's kind of urgent, but we're positive about it.
Yeah. I mean, and how could we not be with so many people already showing up for WAMC?
It is incredible. And we have to thank all that have done something so far. So many of you will do something, and we're hoping you'll do it in the next five and a half minutes now. 1-800-323-9262. And this conversation keeps moving, and we want to keep this conversation going. What is your favorite media source, your trusted, or what should I say, sources? What are your trusted sources? You don't have to mention WAMC, but part of this is to recognize that information is power, that information is so important to each and every one of us that we get the kind of information that is trustworthy. 1-800-323-9262, WAMC.org. And you're hearing Marty Baron talking about coming into the Washington Post and having to lay off people, you know?
Yeah.
The news industry, especially the for-profit news industry, is having a tough time of it. And even public broadcasting is seeing layoffs. So we have a real jewel here in the Northeast to keep going. We need to polish it up now. 1-800-323-9262 so we can shine again.
1-800-323-9262. We are doing an informal, not stringent poll, informal survey, poll of our listeners this morning to let us know what are your trusted media sources. Engage with the conversation, sort of fundraising around this very special roundtable panel, and we're hoping to hear from you.
1-800-323-9262. It's the kind of station where 1-800-323-WAMC, you have people like Amber Sickles all of a sudden tap you on the back and go, hey, look at this.
And that is a challenge we have just now, just Woo-hoo. Hot off the presses. A challenge from Anonymous of Little Falls, New York. It's $1,200, $1,200 from Anonymous in Little Falls, New York, if we can reach 310 in the lockbox by 11:30 today, which is about an hour and a half from now, a little less than an hour and a half from now.
So that's what, $7,300, something like that?
Something like that.
1-800-323-9262.
A little bit less.
73 people at 100?
Right.
That'd do it. A lot more less.
One person at 7,000 and 265 people at $1.
Wow, your math is excellent.
1-800-323-9262. We've changed up things with the lockbox going into this fall fun drive. The difference is we are having full roundtable panels and asking for support during the breaks. You deserve to hear the important conversations discussed by the panel and the experts on the panel, especially in an election year. So we are, kind of switching it up, doing it a little bit differently. In previous fund drives, we've taken over the whole roundtable panel to try to fill the lockbox. We're attempting this new sort of balance because the money is important, but not more important than the message.
WAMC.org, and we are hearing positive feedback about this new way of doing things.
Mostly.
Because people want to hear the information. That is why they're tuning in. And get this fundraising stuff out of the way. But I think more than any other station, our listeners do understand why we're coming to you at this time. And now that we're jiggering with the model and making it so that you can get some real information, some specific information, where you get an exclusive with Marty Baron and then a whole panel of experts talking about the media and how important media is to a democracy. 1-800-323-9262, which of course means democracy. We are all in this together. Let's make this happen now. We got 2 minutes to go.
1-800-323-9262 or online at WAMC.org. In the room with Gussie and Amber and I are four people on phones, one person actually on the phone at the moment. So let's get these other volunteers and staff answering calls. That is what they came in to do, and we don't want to waste their time. 1-800-323-9262. The total raised so far in the lockbox, an absolutely astounding $302,745. We have a challenge on the table, $1,200 from Anonymous in Little Falls, New York, if we can reach 310 by 11:30. Help us. Do any part that you can to help us reach that goal and make that challenge.
1-800-323-9262. And the questions are coming in. Portia from Leverett, Mass. Joe Donahue and panel. Maybe Marty Baron can answer this in the next conversation. What exactly does fact-checking entail? and she says she subscribes to Mother Jones magazine. Fact-checking, what does that entail? That's a great question. Also, Diamond Point, New York. Jay, you keep me sharp. Thank you all for everything you do. I like that.
I do too.
We do keep people sharp.
We're trying. 800-323-9262. Thanks to Eric from High Falls, New York, who says, thank you for so much care and dedication to keeping us well and fairly informed. I wish I were wealthier so I can contribute more. Eric, please do not be concerned about that. You've given, and we can't thank you enough. Thanks to Susan in Ginsburg, New York, who's a
new member.
Woo! Says, I think WAMC is fantastic. I never liked Trump, a real bully. He's not the personality that should represent this country. And we also heard from Jeffrey in Faribault, New York. Thank you, everybody.
Yeah, thank you all for what you've done. You'll keep doing it. We have a $1,200 challenge. We need to make it to $310,000 in the lockbox by 11:30 this morning. And we're going to go back over to Joe Donahue in the panel momentarily, but keep the phones ringing. WAMC.org. I know you want to hear the discussion, but we will post it online. 1-800-323-9262. Be with us. Sarah, this program that you and Joe are a part of is something special.
It's long running, and we'll try to keep doing it, but we can't do it without support from listeners. So thank you, everybody out there. 800-323-9262. Back to the roundtable panel.
Thank you very much, Sarah. Thank you very much, David. And thanks to all the people who are calling in and helping support WAMC and doing the incredible job that you've been doing. Oh, my goodness. So it's WAMC.org, 1-800-323-9262. And, you know, we know how to multitask. So you know how to go to your device and listen to the radio, keep listening to the conversation, and to help us out at the same time. We are joined this morning by Marty Baron. He is the author of the incredible book, Collision of Power, Trump, Bezos, and the Washington Post. The book is just coming out in paperback on Tuesday. It's been out in hardcover for about a year. I just want to quickly say I read the book when it was first out. And then I listened to the audiobook where Liv Schreiber does the narration of the book, who obviously played you in Spotlight, and it's just uncanny. And I don't know how, if you feel it is uncanny, as perhaps many of us do.
Well, look, I was very grateful that he agreed to narrate the book. He did everything but the prologue and the epilogue.
Right, which you do.
Myself, yeah. Which, unfortunately, I had to read right after getting a dental implant, so the day after. But well, that was a challenge. So if you hear a lisp in there, that's the reason. So in any event, the New York Times, you know, actually named it Audiobook of the Week, which was great. But in the review, which was quite entertaining, they said that... that it was a really good idea on my part to delegate everything about the prologue and the epilogue to Liev Schreiber, and because he's really good. He's really good. And I tweeted out, I don't tweet much, but I did tweet out that he's much better at being me than I am at being myself.
Well, it is a really, the book is, as Judy mentioned, is just terrific, and it's very fun to read. But to listen to it and to hear that voice is a lot of fun as well. Marty Baron is our guest. We welcome any letters you have. Panel@WAMC.org, panel@WAMC.org, and we will get to those in just a moment. I am curious about Spotlight and when the movie came out, and even before, as the story broke of how life changed for you.
Well, sure. I'm not sure the life changed for me so much when the story broke, except that I knew that we were onto a really important story, and it was one that not only demonstrated a decades-long cover-up of clergy sexual abuse within the Boston area, the Archdiocese of Boston, but also throughout the country, and now, as we know, throughout the world. I was enormously proud of that work, particularly because it gave voice to people who weren't being heard, the survivors of abuse, and who had not been heard for a very long period of time, not by law enforcement, not by politicians, not by the press, and certainly not by the church. So, you know, when the movie came out, that's a different matter. You know, you start to appreciate the real power of popular culture. And it meant that a lot more people were going to know about that investigation, and that many people would begin to understand the role of the press. And I think, importantly, why we need investigative reporting, how difficult it is to do it correctly, but how necessary it is, and how important it is to listen to people who don't have power, because they often have powerful things to say. So, and it was a reminder, I think, for people within our profession that we need to do investigative work, which had atrophied up to that point because it's expensive, it takes time, it can't guarantee results. But a lot of news organizations rededicated themselves to investigative reporting after that movie came out, and I consider that a great triumph. You know, as for, you know, me personally, you know, it's a little weird. I live in the Berkshires, and I was at a restaurant, and a young man who was still in high school was bussing the table, and he asked if I was Marty Baron, and I said, yeah, how did you know? And he said, oh, the movie. And I said, yeah, I look just like that guy. I was like, how is that possible? Well, it turned out he was a guy who was going into journalism, was going to Northwestern, and was going to study journalism. And so he was sort of attuned to what was happening in the profession. But it's a little strange, but it's an opportunity to talk about things that matter to me and matter to me about the role of the press in our democracy.
Did you?
So journalists are very proud to pat ourselves on the back about how we have standards and we abide by our standards. But from small local newspapers to big papers and big all kinds of media companies are faced with shifting standards, it seems to me, with the rise especially of social media, with AI. Are you seeing that our standards have changed? And what advice can you give to the next generation of journalists about, you know, what standards are immutable and how do you adapt to those changes? I, as an old school journalist, I really had a hard time when people started tweeting or expressing their opinions on social media. You know, it's something that I really had a hard time getting used to. Where do you think the state of our standards are?
Well, I hope you don't get used to it. Nominally, we all say that we have the same standards, but the truth is that they're not always enforced, and they should be. Otherwise, we're not telling the truth to the public. If we say we have a certain set of standards and we don't enforce them, then we're not being truthful with the public. I think that I do worry that social media has sort of opened the floodgates to a lot of commentary that is destructive to our reputations, that it leads people to be impulsive in their commentary. They're retweeting things that are really not verified, which just sort of runs entirely contrary to the very purpose of genuine journalism, which is the process of verification. People are being sarcastic, snarky. There's a lot of awful humor. There is sometimes even people criticizing their own colleagues in their own newsroom, their own supervisors, their own news organizations. I find that entirely inappropriate and antithetical to the idea of a really constructive workplace and collaborative workplace. I think we should rethink all of that. I think it does hurt our institution. You know, we're not just a random collection of individuals in a newsroom. We are and should be an institution with collective standards. Those standards should be clearly stated. They should be stated internally and stated externally. And in order to give meaning to those standards, we should abide by them and enforce them. Otherwise, they are standards in name only. I do think that we should, I do believe in objective journalism. And by that, I mean, I don't mean false balance by any means. I don't believe in false balance. I think that we should always approach stories with an open mind, willing to listen to everybody, genuinely listen, look at all of the evidence, talk to all of the appropriate people. Objectivity is a search for the truth, a search for the facts, and putting them in proper context. And so, and once we've done all that work, once we've done it comprehensively and rigorously and independently and objectively and honestly and honorably, Then we tell people what we found and tell it to them directly and forthrightly and unflinchingly. And so that's the standard that I believe that we should adhere to. And I think we should fundamentally let our journalism speak for itself. I'm very glad that during the investigation of the Catholic Church by the Boston Globe, we didn't actually have social media at the time. So when we published our first story in the beginning of 2002 and published over 900 stories after that over the next year and a half, that we didn't have people on the staff going on social media and talking about things that were completely irrelevant. So not talking about some experience that they had in Catholic school, not talking about the issue of celibacy, not talking about, I mean, some people would have. They might have gone talking about celibacy. Right. They might have talked about whether the church had moral authority because of its position on abortion or something like that, or on gay rights or whatever it might be. But that was totally irrelevant to what we were doing in our stories. What we were doing in those stories is that we were disclosing a crime and disclosing the fact that the church had covered up those crimes, serial crimes, by multiple, many, many priests over decades. That's all. That's all we were doing, and that's what the journalism said. And I would not have wanted people going onto social media to make all sorts of other impulsive and irrelevant comments.
Mike. Marty, when you were talking about your experience with Jeff Bezos at the Washington Post, you mentioned how he said, you know, the internet has great potential for the newspaper. And you said that you noted that the irony of how the internet just decimated so many local newspapers and took away their ad base and just gouged, you know, left the newsrooms being wastelands almost, it seems, compared to the way it was. Do you have any optimism that local journalism can survive in a new model? And what kind of models do you think have potential to survive for local journalism?
Yeah, well, I do have optimism, and it's good that I'm glad you raise it because it's important to talk about that. I mean, I think local journalism is really in crisis in this country. That is where the biggest crisis for journalism is. But the very fact that we have, you know, outlets such as this one, WAMC, continuing doing good work, I think it's really important. And hey, everybody, make a donation.
Thank you, sir.
Spirit of the program and spirit of the moment here. Contribute to, you know, to public radio and to public media and to media generally. I mean, I think if you find news organizations that are doing good work, that are covering their communities, covering not just the issues that divide us, but which is sometimes often necessary, but the issues that bind us together, our arts, the sports, the all the contributions to our communities, you know, that needs the support. The support of people in those communities. It can't be done. It's not, people think, oh, well, we should get it all for free. But, you know, people who do that work, they need to get paid. And the only way to pay them is with income for their news organizations. And so I think I do have optimism because I continue to see a lot of really great work. Because I do see some new models that are emerging, fully digital models, some nonprofit models, some commercial models that are doing quite well. I see news organizations in Minneapolis and in New Orleans and Baton Rouge, where I just was, or San Francisco, where they're growing. They're adding people. They're doing significant work. They are doing investigations in addition to covering the subjects that bind their communities together. I see some nonprofits that are doing quite well that have garnered the support, digital nonprofits that have garnered the support of their communities. I was just recently in Pennsylvania, and Spotlight PA, for example, is a nonprofit that does investigative work, and they are growing as well with the support of philanthropies and individual contributions. And by the way, you have some philanthropies now that are paying an enormous attention to the plight of local journalism. I happen to be on the board of the Knight Foundation, which is the primary supporter of journalism in this country among philanthropic institutions. But now the MacArthur Foundation has also spearheaded an effort called Press Forward. They've raised from themselves, the Knight Foundation, and from community foundations, $500 million over 5 years. And they hope to bring that up to $1 billion to help support local journalism and basically bring down the cost of the infrastructure so that these sites can operate with very low levels of cost. And so I see a lot of things that are really encouraging. And so I am optimistic. It's not easy. I'm not Pollyannish about it by any means. Their challenges are enormous. AI, you mentioned generative AI. Artificial intelligence is a huge challenge because, you know, now on Google, it offers you sometimes Gen AI answers. So you don't have to actually go to the stories. They don't have links. And also AI means that there's going to be a lot of fabricated visual images, still images, video images, a lot of fabricated audio. And worse than that, I mean, even beyond that, I should say, it's going to allow people, when there is verified audio and video, people who feel that they've been hurt by that will say it's generated by AI. And so the result is that a lot of people in the public will conclude that it's impossible to discern what is true and what is false, and that it's not worth the trouble trying. And so they'll just believe whatever their own ideological leaders happen to say. And that's a dangerous place. It's a dangerous place, not just for journalism, but well beyond that, for society as a whole. When you can't conclude what's true and what's false, that's dangerous territory for us all.
Jay?
So I know we have limited time, and there's two questions I want to ask you. One, and they're completely different, but I think if I had a preference, it's going to be the one I do ask. So I'm curious about, you know, the aftermath of the investigation on the Catholic Church and where we are today with it. I had gone to Italy some years ago, and just a few years back, and was touring the Vatican, and was just it's breathtaking, the wealth of the church. And I came back and we were right in the middle of an editorial board discussion about the diocese making what many people felt, this is the Albany diocese, making what many people felt were inadequate settlement offers and threatening bankruptcy, and, you know, throwing that guilt on the survivors. That if you don't take our offer and you add, and we all have to go to court, well, we're probably going to go bankrupt. And I'm just wondering, you know, how do you think the aftermath of this has gone in terms of making the victims of this whole, and whether the church, as the global institution that it is, you know, has owned up to its responsibility or kind of taken a very corporate approach to it?
Yeah, well, you're right that a lot of dioceses have declared bankruptcy. Vermont, the diocese in Vermont just declared bankruptcy. And there's something like 35 of them in the United States that have declared bankruptcy. You know, I mean, I think there have been some significant reforms in the church. I think the Boston Archdiocese has done pretty well at addressing this. I mean, that was the epicenter of all of this because of the coverage of the Globe. And there are other dioceses around the country that have taken this quite seriously. I still think there are some where the cardinals are highly resistant to acknowledging the failures of the church in this regard, and certainly resistant to any to compensation for the survivors of abuse, people who were victimized. I think overall, the Vatican, it took a long time for them to acknowledge their failings. They actually, since then, believe it or not, they've actually come to thank the press for its role in disclosing these abuses and in disclosing the cover-up. I'm not sure all cardinals and bishops subscribe to that view, but
no, they don't.
that is the officially stated view of the Vatican. But I get concerned because... I mean, if, for example, recently in Spain, there were a couple of reports that disclosed the extent of abuse there, and the church has been extremely resistant to doing anything. And then also, you know, I look at, in a way, it's the dog that doesn't bark, and that is, where are the abuse cases in the areas of the world where the church is growing fastest? That would be Africa and Asia. Well, you don't hear about any of that. Why is that? Okay. And that is because there isn't pressure from the government and there isn't pressure from the press. And if there's no pressure on from the government or the press, it appears that the church doesn't do anything on its own. It's not possible that in those parts of the world, it is not hearing accounts of abuse. Mm-hmm. And the question is, if it were truly forthright about this, it would address this issue on its own without any pressure from anybody else.
Go with your second question.
I will. this is my Home Depot question. So many years ago when Home Depot first opened, you know, you could not walk in there without getting help with on any square foot of the store. And then, you know, slowly it dissipated. And, you know, today you walk in and you have to search for a salesperson. And I kind of thought of Jeff Bezos buying the Washington Post when it first came in. I wondered if it was going to be the same thing, that it seemed like, and I will admit I violated a commandment there in terms of coveting how much resources he devoted to that. And I wonder, in your experience, by the time you left, you mentioned that you had to do some cuts your first year there, how the newsroom compared in size and resources from when you came in to when you left. And did you get the feeling, as I did from afar, that Bezos saw it as much as a mission as a business investment, if not more?
Yeah, right. Well, first of all, I sympathize with your Home Depot. I think I've walked miles on a Home Depot looking for a service person to help me. But in any event, look, I mean, our staff, by the time I left, we had 1,000 people in our newsroom. When I first got there, in the beginning of 2013, we had 580. I cut about 35 in the first year. So we nearly doubled the size of the staff. By the time I left, we had the largest foreign staff ever in the history of the Post. We had reestablished bureaus around the country. We had increased our coverage, for example, of technology. I mean, we hardly had coverage of technology before that. And by the time I left, we had a really substantial staff doing that. I do think that he wants it to be a sustainable business. And I have always told people at the Post that I thought that was good, that he didn't treat us like a charity, because if someday he decided he didn't want to have that charity anymore, we would be in very terrible shape. And we should use the opportunity of his smarts and his investment to create a sustainable enterprise so that it can survive whether Jeff Bezos is there or not. More recently, of course, they've had highly publicized problems, financial problems. A lot of that is, I think, because they way overspent, way overexpanded after I left. We didn't prepare adequately for a post-Trump era. A lot of our growth and support in terms of subscriptions came from people who, you know, favored our investigations, who wanted us to hold Trump accountable, who were keenly interested in politics. And politics became less interesting with Joe Biden. When Joe Biden entered the White House, a lot of people felt that the threat to democracy had disappeared. They didn't have to worry about it anymore. They once again took the press for granted, which I don't think they ever should do. And there were other reasons. You know, discount offers were expiring, and people were being asked to pay full price, and all of that. So subscriptions fell, and readership fell. And they've paid the price for that with some very substantial losses. They're now embarked on an effort to correct that. We'll see if they can do that. I still have confidence that they will. But I do think Bezos sees it as more than a business. Look, it's not the best business to go into. He would not have bought the Washington Post because he thinks that's a great business to go into. You know, there's a joke in the business is, what do you call a billionaire who buys a newspaper? A millionaire. And because of the pressure that was brought on, I mean, Bezos suffered an enormous amount of pressure that was not helpful to his primary business, which is Amazon, of course. And, you know, Trump talked about as early as the campaign in 2015 and 2016, he talked about increasing postal rates on package deliveries, doubling them, tripling them, quadrupling them. He was just making up the number as he went along. And then, of course, he interfered in a big Defense Department cloud computing contract, a $10 billion contract, to make sure that it did not go to Amazon. And so, you know, when Amazon lost out on that contract, the joke in the business was that it didn't cost Bezos $250 million to buy the Post. It cost him $10,250,000,000 to buy the Post. That was the joke. I don't know that Jeff Bezos appreciated the joke. The rest of us did, but But in any event, I mean, I think that he does see it as an important part of our democracy. I think he actually really believes that it's an important institution, and that it's a pillar of democracy, and that's why he's been committed to it. But he does want it to be self-sustaining, and I think that's a reasonable expectation for any enterprise, and particularly for the Post, and it needs to be self-sustaining over the long run. And so they're grappling with that right now. And there's naturally a lot of grumbling about that. But I think it's really important that they become self-sustaining. They should be able to survive whether Bezos owns them or not. Mm-hmm. And they should use this opportunity of his ownership to create a sustainable model.
Well, unfortunately, we are out of time, but I just want to say thank you so much to Marty Baron for being with us and for spending time on this special Lockbox edition. It's really has been a delight and a real honor to have you on the program. The name of the book is Collision of Power. It is going to be out in paperback on Tuesday, currently out in hardcover. If you just can't wait till Tuesday, that's fine too. And it is from on behalf of all of my colleagues here, Marty, thank you so much for the time and for the great work that you've done and for being a hero to so many of us.
Great. Well, thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Great pleasure.
Thank you
very much. Be well.
Thank you.
Again, we are very thankful to have had Marty Baron for the time and are very thankful for all of you to call in and to support programs like this. So how do you do that? Well, I have two incredible people for you to meet in the room right next door, and they'll tell you about exactly how to do that right now.
Precisely how to do it.
Okay. Oh, well, how do we do it?
You, one out there listening, dials 1-800-323-9262. A lovely volunteer or staff member answers their call. Ask them a few questions, including how much they would like to donate to WAMC, and then we're golden, baby.
That is amazing. And the number is 800-323-9262, or you can go online at wamc.org. What a great interview, and what a great roundtable panel that was. Holy moly.
They had a lot of insight given Martin Baron's career and all of the excellent journalists we have in the studio. Just fantastic. That's the kind of programming we aim to bring you regularly, and you can help us continue to bring you such programming by donating to the station. The phone number is 1-800-323-9262. The website is wamc.org, and we do have a challenge on the table. We are trying to reach the $310,000 point in the lockbox by 11:30 today, which is just under an hour from now, and we're currently at 303-621, so we have a 6,000 and change to go in the challenge. Can you help us make it, s'il vous plaît?
Oh, that's French. 800-323-9262. That's the number, and I guess we have some people to thank.
We do indeed. Thank you to Christine from Albany, New York, who loves the roundtable. Thanks to Nancy in Suffield, Connecticut, to John in Little Falls, New York, who says, keep up the good work. You are all very much appreciated. Thanks to Anonymous in Bennington, Vermont. Anonymous in Poughkeepsie is a new member. Thanks to Barbara in Brooklyn, New York, listener for 30 years, trusted news sources.
Not in nude sources.
News.
Because that's a different outlet.
Yeah. I'm sure that you have your trusted nude sources.
Oh, yes,
indeed,
we do. But
this is news sources we're discussing this morning.
I'm a never nude.
I love that. Critically, NPR, Democracy Now!, and for the Middle East, Al Jazeera. Those are the news sources that Barbara trusts and listens to. We also heard from Philip in Queensbury, New York, and Laura in Chesterfield, Massachusetts. Thank you so much.
WAMC.org is a place where you can make your online pledge. You can get content out the yin-yang, as some people say. There is so much stuff. There is no paywall. You want to go. You want to hear a roundtable panel from 6 months ago. There it is.
It is.
It's all there at WAMC.org.
6 years ago, maybe not. But maybe.
Well, it's probably there.
It could be. It depends.
Deeply enough. But we need you now. We have a challenge on the table. We have to hit a $310,000 benchmark. What a great stretch.
Yes.
And how great are the WAMC members? I can never even quantify it. Everybody has been so fantastic. We need more people to be fantastic. If you haven't made your pledge,
Do it. WAMC.org or 800-323-9262.
1-800-323-9262. We do have on our screen up here that tells us the total raised in the lockbox so far. It also tells us the number of pledges,
yeah,
which this lockbox period thus far is 2,356. 2,356 people is a lot of generous people.
Heck yeah.
A lot of people who've shown up, who believe in WAMC, who have been able to afford to pledge and have given some of their hard-earned money to the station to keep us on the air. But I know that there's literally, truly, thousands and thousands more people out there potentially listening, and we would love to convince some of you to call in now as well.
How cool was it that this morning we had a challenge from Chicago, Illinois?
Very cool.
In Chicago.
The
love
Windy
that.
City. And the toddling town.
Not that it's any better than Little Falls. It's just much further away.
It is.
Farther away? Oh, God, I can never remember.
We need to Google
one,
that.
One
learn.
Is for distance.
Yes.
I think that's farther.
Yes.
And then metaphorically and conceptually further. I think that's what it is. But you know what? As you can tell by listening to any of my programs, I'm hardly very good at English.
Oh, please.
Stephen in Albany, thanks, man. You listened. You asked for our trusted media sources,
we
says
did.
Stephen.
We still are.
So here goes. WAMC, NPR, Heather Cox Richardson's Letters from, that's plural, Letters from an American. Please try to get her as a guest. Thank you for all that you do. Let's save democracy. That's from Stephen. Thanks to Joseph in Barneveld, New York. Thank you for all that the station does. After hearing the sustaining members allow the station better plan, we have transitioned. In truth, the programs provided.
It's okay. It's okay.
The
it's
font
Friday.
Is very small.
Do your best.
Hang on. I'm just trying to. After hearing that, sustaining members allow the station better plan.
Probably to
Did
plan better or to better plan. Just a missed word, I would think.
Oh, I understand.
Which is very human.
We have
relatable.
This is what happens on Vox Pop. I'm reading the emails
sure.
off the phone, and oftentimes there'll be no punctuation, and then.
Yeah.
You know, I sound even more incompetent than usual. In truth,
no.
In truth, Joseph says, the programs provided are a daily sustenance, feeding our intellect and curiosity.
Oh,
the
wow.
truth matters. Thanks for providing that above all. And that's from Joe and Kelly of Barneveld, New York.
Who are? Sustaining members.
Oh, yeah, you saw that, and I didn't.
They mentioned it in the comment.
Splendid.
That you read. 1-800-323-9262, 1-800-323-9262, or online at WAMC.org. We are going to return to Studio D in a minute or two to have the panel wrap up, the remaining marvelous panelists giving of their time and expertise. We have some real friends in there today that come through for us all the time. They're on multiple programs. Sometimes they're on the round table multiple times a week if other people need to bail for any assorted life reason.
Yep.
They're
you always
fantastic
have to
folks.
Lean on your friends. And that's what we're doing right
yeah.
now. We need your friend. 800-323-9262 or WAMC.org. We're making progress in this challenge. We're at 304-032. We need to hit 310 by 11:30, and we'll get an extra $1,200, 12 large, from Anonymous of Little Falls, New York.
We are in the 5,000s left to raise, still nearly 6,000, but in the 5,000s left to raise in the challenge.
Yeah, buddy.
And we hope that when we return for an extended pitch break after the end of the panel, that we will have gotten even closer, and then we'll make it in due time, and then keep it rolling. Keep it rocking and a rolling.
I missed the memo. When are we going back to the panel?
Now.
Oh, well,
or anytime.
Goodbye.
We return to Studio D.
Keep pledging.
Thank you very much. Thanks to Sarah LaDuc and Ray Graff and the great work they are doing on this Friday, the 4th of October, and a special edition of the Roundtable. And again, thanks to Marty Baron for being with us for an in-depth discussion. I am lucky enough to be with our panelists, and we'll be with you up till the top of the hour and have some time to dissect what we just heard a moment ago, and also go over some of the listener questions. We have many, and certainly would like to go through those as well. But keep pledging, 1-800-323-9262, WAMC.org. Jay Jochnowitz is with us, Judy Patrick and Mike Spain, and we welcome you, panel at WAMC.org. So what'd you make of that, Judy?
Ah, pretty darn good.
That was fun, wasn't it?
Man, talking. It's. I felt like I was talking to a journalism legend.
You know? Well, that's yeah.
Yeah, and I so appreciate the fact that he is out there still making the case for good journalism yeah. because he could just be sitting there fly fishing or something else. You know, but
not that there's anything wrong. I've
gotten in trouble with this before. It's true, but he's out there, you know, answering the questions and making the case that journalism matters and that we need to still be out there doing our jobs day in and day out despite the economic pressures we're all facing.
And in so many ways, just it's fascinating that, you know, someone at that level is thinking about thinking and worrying and talking and struggling with the same issues that we, you know, we're kind of struggling at the local level. And it's just, you know, kind of magnified because you're a national player. But it was very human.
Wouldn't it be nice to have a newsroom of 1,000 people, though? Can you imagine?
Oh, God. I know. I saw your eyes all light up when he was talking about how many people they had.
You have to get on the elevator to go see people.
I was on a webinar or something with a web meeting of some sort with a Times editor, and there was a Washington Post editor as well on the thing. And the Times editor said something about they were comparing newsrooms, and it was funny. I think the Times was somewhere around 1,500, and he said, "You're around." At that point, it was like 900 and something or 1,000 something. And I'm sitting there with, what are we down to at the Times Union? You know, it's about 70 when you count up all the bodies.
Yeah. Right. And there are so many local newspapers out there right now putting out papers, running websites on one or two reporters. Yep. And, you know, they're the heroes as well.
We have letters, and just a reminder about the letters that they came in through the course of our hour-plus conversation. So they're about – some of them can be about very specific things, not sort of an overall look back, but some very specific things that were parts of the conversation. With that said, I think some interesting things to look at. Brian writes to us and says, the discussion misses some key points. The press should fact-check debates because – if one candidate lies a lot, the other has to spend time countering that and can't present their own message and has little credibility in that role as opponent.
You know, I appreciate that argument. I really do. You know, we had the same challenge when we had a blog, which I just hated doing a blog. People would be angry at me for taking their comments off, and I said, "Look, we are no more going to allow inaccurate information on a blog than we would allow it in print." And it's that simple, and it's the same thing with our, you know, with our printed opinion section. That, you know, yes, you're in, you know, it's a hack phrase, but you're entitled to your opinion. You're not entitled to your own facts. And when you're on a national stage like that, to allow a falsehood to pass, you know, I appreciate what he said about, you know, it's kind of the job in a debate of the debaters to fact check each other. But, you know, on the other hand, you're a news person, you're a moderator, you're sitting there, and I can't imagine letting a blatant inaccuracy pass.
Yeah, but they fact checked the big lies, the major miss, which made some people might have inferred that everything else was true. And there were so many lies in some of the responses that maybe we shouldn't even have these kinds of debates if we can't trust the participants to at least try to stick to a little bit of the truth.
But I was not startled but surprised by what Marty Baron said, and I think he's unfortunately correct, is that, you know, you do your fact checking, you do it, it's your due diligence after a speech by a politician or after a debate or whatever, an interview on TV, and you reveal that they made a lie or they made a completely false statement, whatever, and demonstrate that, it doesn't seem to swing the needle very much. No. People don't, you know, and this is the reality, and it hit me as Marty Baron was pointing it out, that people don't necessarily change their opinion about Donald Trump. They know everything about Donald Trump. They know he lies. They may not like him personally. They may not like his business dealings, but they
are angry, and he is their weapon to express that anger. I mean, that's my way of describing what Marty
vengeance,
said.
I think he said.
But yeah. But it's they you know, we can do, we the media can do a very, very thorough job doing it right, fact checking, making sure that people are you know, held accountable when they make misstatements and report what's going on in the campaign, and it's not enough. It's it we do our job. It's not our fault that it hasn't you know, if the outcome is not desirable.
We have one or two more letters along the same, in the same vein. One being from Richard. Just this past weekend, I heard an NPR reporter that say that Trump accused Harris of blocking the bill to address the immigration problem. The reporter did not note this was a lie. Repeating the lie without challenging it was de facto supporting Trump. I don't know if it goes as far as supporting Trump, but it is certainly not the complete picture, and for want of a better term, perhaps sloppy.
I missed that one, and boy, is that outrageous, considering he's the one who tanked it. I mean, went out of his way to tank the bill.
Right.
Yeah, that...
The assertion in the vice presidential debate that... that Trump tried to bolster and save the Affordable Care Act.
Is another one.
I mean, yeah. How, you know, it's like saying the earth is flat. You know, I mean, do you need to always stop everybody in the middle of a sentence and say that's not true when it's so obviously a falsehood?
I mean, to Rick's point, though, in reporting, if you say that something along the lines of the accusation was made, but then you don't make the extra step, which is the accusation, which is not true, which is what I think this listener was looking
for. Is it the real-time live interview on camera with a reporter, or is it a reporter that then writes a print story or an online posting and says, you know, that the candidate falsely stated or stated this, which was completely false because dot, dot, dot. You know, I mean, does it have to be real time? Not everybody is capable of having that compendium of knowledge to be able to call somebody out in every little fact. And then the interview would just sort of become a brickbrack. I mean, you have to let people speak. I don't know. You know, it's tough.
And these are really rules we're talking about for a very specific pair of people, Donald Trump and J.D. Vance. To keep up with that volume, particularly from Trump, is just, it would require almost an encyclopedic knowledge on the reporter's part. And, you know, you could have that kind of knowledge maybe on a city beat or something like that, or in sports or something. But, you know, to keep up with Donald Trump, who just invents fresh lies every 5 minutes, every sentence almost.
You know, this speaks to our standards, because I think at the local level, neither one of you probably would have allowed a story to go by into print that was just an accusation.
Right.
I mean, we wouldn't. We don't print those.
We get the response.
We get the response. Or,
if it's completely off the wall, we just ignore it.
Exactly. And that's how it worked for generations. But this presidential candidate has, you know, thrown us all into a tizzy that we don't know what to do, when if we just went back to maybe we shouldn't even be printing this at all, although it is hard to ignore.
Yeah.
Let's go to just a few more letters again, some in the same vein, but I think important to address. For example, Ruth making a similar point. Trump spews nonstop lies. It's rare he says anything true. If Harris or Biden before her tried to fact check him live, they would have spent their entire lot of time doing that. Then they would have been criticized for not laying out their positive positions, and then saying that we don't know more about the candidate. If she ignores the lies and just speaks affirmatively, she's criticized for not fact checking. It's a no-win situation. You cannot debate someone like him.
It's a good point.
Yeah.
It's a very fair point. I think he is unique in American politics at that level anyway. I'm sure there are people at the local level who are that difficult to deal with at one point or another. But how do you deal with someone who doesn't deal in facts or reality? And to Judy's point, you end up with, if you say, we're just not going to bother with the lies, or we're not going to bother with the fabrications of the unfounded material, then people want to know what the classic thing you hear from your callers and your letter writers, why aren't you covering this? It's not true. It doesn't exist. Why would we waste time on it? Yeah.
Marty Baron used a term, false balance. That's a different way to describe, you know, this equivalent where, you know, a spokesman for the mafia said that there were no crimes were committed after the U.S. attorney charged them, or saying a spokesman for the Nazis say that wasn't true at all. I mean, we don't have to go and get a commentary, you know, like treat each person's assertion as if one is legitimate and the other is legitimate. Often they're so illegitimate they don't need to be responded to. You know,
NASA shows new views of Earth from space. Oh, now we'll hear from the Flat Earth Society.
Right, yeah, right. Exactly. Yeah. I mean, that's the absurd example. Yeah.
Well, the NRA, right, of coming out after a school shooting.
Yeah, and saying that this is not the time to talk about it. If we had people with guns in schools, they'd be safer. You know, I mean, yeah.
Rachel, you know, we all have those things that just, you know, get under our skin.
Well,
and just, you know, they pick and they pick and they pick. Okay, so the thing Rachel gets upset about, and I understand it, but I would share it with you all, about the role of the press, repeatedly referring to Trump as former president or inaccurately president is one of the worst habits of the press. His actions have clearly shown him to be not worthy of these honorifics. At least, very least, additional descriptions relating to his disrespect of the rule of law and the military, his long list of criminal actions, should be more often attached to him as a way of identification, such as felon, etc. I understand the point, but I do think we go back, many of us go back to a calmer time. A simpler time for example, we refer to Ambassador Fred Hoff as Ambassador Fred Hoff because he served as an ambassador and he earned that title and will continue to do it as you would with a senator or a vice president. And so I don't know, and I don't know, for example, I guess I'm caught up on how much, what damage it does, or how it helps. Even, I mean, Trump was president for 4 years, so saying former president is true. Using the term Mr. President is what we do with all other former presidents.
To all other former presidents, right? Yeah.
Yes. So it's a hard thing to come around. I get the point, but it's not really journalism's job to make that decision that he's not worthy of those honorifics.
Hmm. Well, I don't remember how I dealt with this in Sunday's in the editorial we're doing for Sunday, but I do remember actually having this discussion with myself internally about what to call everybody in the piece, because we do use honorifics in editorials. And I think on first reference, I called him former President Donald Trump. But through the rest of the piece, he's Mr. Trump. He's no longer President Trump in terms of our style. And I would do the same thing with Obama, and I would do the same thing with Bush and anybody else. On the other hand, Vance gets the title senator on second reference throughout. So he's Senator Vance throughout, and Kamala Harris would be vice president.
Throughout.
But she's also, I don't awkwardly say Vice President Harris all through it. So, you know, there are standards for this, and we should just stick to our standards and not worry about what, you know.
Well, do you think that the
understand
norms,
it grates on people that we call him even former president?
Yes. Yeah.
Do you guys think that the norms will return in the post-Trump era, whenever that begins, you know, that we'll get back to the pre-Trump norms of you know, civility that had kind of gone by the wayside since?
You mean like liking people? And
well, no, I just meant being able to talk to people you don't like without having to insult them.
Carnage.
Right. without having to stab people in the face when you're talking to them if you don't like them. You could still be respectful and back and forth.
Well, I don't know. Your family may vary, but I don't think any, you know, like people talk about, oh, Thanksgiving dinner is so awkward. Well, Thanksgiving dinner has been awkward since I was born. I don't know. It's always been awkward. I don't think that's going to change. But to your point, you hope so, right? I mean, yeah. You hope that at least there is a moment where my dad in his retirement was writing a book about the statuary in Washington, D.C. And my father just had this point that the government in D.C. just did things so beautifully when they had ceremonies, when they had the color guard, when they had the band, when they had these events of how beautiful and stately they were. And, you know, we lose a lot of that now because of, well, for a couple of reasons. I mean, one, of course, is security and safety and money and all of those things. But, you know, I do hope it would be nice to get back to that where there is a respect for the office of whatever that office is and a respect for the person. I mean, I remember being but in 1976 to a political rally to see the president of the United States.
Gerald Ford?
Gerald Ford at the Plymouth Meeting Mall. And not because we were Team Ford, because the president was coming to town and we were going to go see the president of the United States.
Exactly.
And that was a big, big deal and something obviously I'll never forget.
The collegiality of both sides, you know, not just constantly attacking each other, but having respect. You know, Biden promised that when he was running for election. He tried to do it, but it has been impossible because I think Election Day began, 2024 began the day after he was inaugurated, it seems.
You know, I still can't get over the fact that Donald Trump did not attend. Former President Donald Trump did not attend the inauguration of Joe Biden. It was such a...
That was part of the peaceful transfer of power that J.D. Vance talked about on January 20th?
Yeah. Mike Pence sat in and welcomed the Bidens to the White House that day.
Yeah. Right. And yet again, something that has... But, you know, I just read... there was an article this morning about... We still don't have the medical records on
exactly.
On
He's
Donald
promised
Trump.
Them and promised them and promised them.
We don't have the medical records, the taxes, the things that were the norms of the office.
Yeah. And I just hope it will go back in the post-Trump era.
Well, let's just hope for a post-Trump era. Mm. Because perhaps J.D. Vance is the post-Trump era.
Apparent,
era.
Yes. Yeah.
But even he might be different. I mean, I don't. I wasn't. I mean, the
different
fact that
in
he,
how
he
different, better,
so,
different.
Well, you know, he's not. Let's say, at least, I didn't watch. I don't watch the rally, so I don't know if he's quite the same. But you know, I watch someone like Ron DeSantis, and I think you know, in many ways, he's worse. He's as bad, if not worse, than Trump when it comes to using the press as a foil. That he just attacks reporters right from the podium when they're in the middle of asking a question. And I've dealt with politicians like that very rarely, but you know, Tom Whalen was like that. I'd be in a personal interview with him, and former mayor. You know, but I think J.D. Vance has
There's
a certain
a
sense
of him
civility.
And his dog on Broadway.
I know. That was a great dog.
That was a great dog.
Finn was a wonderful dog. I used to love just walking into the office just to see Finn.
But he was combative sometimes with reporters.
He could
sometimes.
Be.
The dog
not
or the
Finn,
mayor?
Not Finn, the mayor.
And speaking of
mayor.
The mayor, yes. But that's, yes. I don't know about Finn.
What was my point? There are some politicians that are difficult to deal with and some aren't. But I think, you know, when you talk about the post-Trump era, I think what Trump is an extension of kind of right-wing radio that, you know, I listened to it for years before Trump came in, and he was just a natural evolution. The Tea Party and right-wing radio were take no prisoners. There is nothing to like about the other side. They're all out to destroy the country.
Zero sum.
It really is. And I don't know if that is going to go away with Donald Trump. It's a good question. If he loses, and he loses, I'd like to think spectacularly, there may be a rethinking about whether the, you know, that power base of the Republican Party, that base of the Republican Party, is what the Republican Party needs to listen to. I don't know.
Well, I want to. We're gonna throw it over to Pledge Central and round out today with some good old fashioned fundraising. I just want to take just a moment to, of course, thank Marty Baron for being with us. Here's a guy who not only has had this incredible career with the Miami Herald and the Boston Globe and the Washington Post and this amazing book and Spotlight ... but lives in our region and lives in our lives here and is supporting the station and working with us and helping us raise money. And I just appreciate that so much and how all of you have responded to it. And I just, thank the God of my choice every day for having such wonderful colleagues as Mike Spain, Judy Patrick, and Jay Jochnowitz, who are wonderful journalists, who have always been wonderful journalists in this region.